Welcome back to the Landmarks Commission hearing. We are getting ready to start the second item on the agenda, which is what's been called a briefing of the Historic Resources Code Project. It's really more like a work session. We do have Brandon Spencer Hartle here from BDS to answer questions, talk us through ideas, but he's not really giving a presentation. Instead, I think those of us who are part of the smaller subcommittee, Commissioner Spears couldn't make it today, so it's really just myself and Commissioner Roman, I think, who might be leading us a little bit. But if anybody else has had a chance to read through, you may, just have questions or comments at this point. So we can just go ahead and dive in as a sort of informal discussion. Does that sound good, Commissioner Roman, especially? Yeah, okay. So I'll start. The Historic Resources Code Project, we've certainly seen before, but it has been a while. It's been quite a while, in fact, since this commission saw the latest iteration, and it has changed. There are aspects of it that I think came as a bit of a surprise to me. And to members of the subcommittee as well. There are some really great things in the code, as well as some things that I think we're confused by or maybe concerned by. And I do want to hit some of those high points, and I'm gonna just go ahead and start with that. And Commissioner Roman, please do just, jump in. Like I said, this is totally informal. I don't have any sort of, presentation or anything like that. So some of the exciting things in the new proposed code project are around what I think has been an issue with this commission. It's been an issue at BDS, and it's been an issue at BPS, which is the idea of, somewhat over-regulation. So trying to find an appropriate level of regulations that cover historic districts. But also, I guess, all of the, all of the resources are a series of new exemptions in here. I really would appreciate anybody's help to go through that with a fine-tooth comb with us, but I personally am not terribly worried about any of these new exemptions. There are some new exemptions for solar, for instance, that allow greater latitude. And there are exemptions that allow more, a larger buildable area. And we can certainly talk about that one if you want. Without review. So this is a lot. There's so much code here that if anybody is trying to keep in the back of my mind, where can I sort of pitch in? That would be one place where I would really love to have another commissioner say, oh yes, I'm certainly willing to go through those in greater detail and offer some more feedback, and perhaps let the subcommittee focus on a little bit higher level. But again, from me, I'm not terribly worried about any of them just on a first read. Another thing I want to specifically mention is that the conservation districts have been an ongoing point of confusion for most of us. And if they're confusing to us, you can be certain that they're confusing for just about everyone else in the city. What has been confusing about them is the level of regulation that has been applied to conservation districts. That has been some, you know, we've seen a lot of demolition in certain conservation districts, a lot of loss of historic fabric. And I think all of us have sort of scratched our heads and thought, well, you know, what exactly are we conserving here? You know, what is the role of a conservation district? What is it supposed to be? And one really great development in this proposal is that demolition review is now going to be applied to contributing properties within conservation districts. And I think that's going to go a long way in stemming those losses that we've seen in conservation districts. I do think, and I'm going to get there pretty soon, there are some other unanswered questions for me around conservation districts. And, you know, I look at this HRCP as a real moment in time, an opportunity to better define conservation districts in relationship to historic districts. Brandon has done some real work about trying to define these different levels of historic resources in the city, right? We have been sort of tasked with how do we deal with National Register listings if those, you know, are being treated differently than they, you know, than we have been treating them. And traditionally, of course, you know, they have been what I think Brandon has called our gold standard. So we've given National Register in the state of Oregon just automatic protections, pretty much automatic, you know, highest level of reviews. And now with the state code changes, we are trying to transition to something closer to what most other states do, which is not treat National Register as sort of a part of their, you know, their own local rights and responsibilities, but instead look on National Register as being something purely honorary. I would say, you know, we're not there yet. We still have some protections that apply automatically, in other words, demo review. But we as a city, I think, need to deal with what it means to be each of these specific national or specific designations in a city hierarchy. So, there are some other good things also, but this actually seems like a really good moment for me to talk about conservation districts a little bit more, because I want to dive into that. That for me is one of the, I guess, disappointments in this code package, because I see local designation as being an opportunity to be a lot more flexible, a lot more, I guess, locally defined, if you will. And by local, I really mean, you know, giving that neighborhood a voice. And I'm concerned with the hierarchy of resources that's being proposed right now. National Register is a really high bar to enter the system. And yet, you know, that's being kind of put down, you know, in this, you know, as Brandon calls it, that's sort of the bronze level. And in terms of level of protection, that works fine. But it's not a very good way to treat National Register resources, considering, you know, the sort of level of technical requirements to enter the system. And so that's where it falls down for me. And it also falls down for me where the degree of physical change expected should also sort of flow, you know, in an orderly manner. So Brandon, maybe this is a good point for you to talk about trying to slot in National Register resources and just give us some insight into, you know, the balancing act that you've had to do with trying to fit those into a hierarchy.
Yeah, good question, Charminer. And I think this is, how do I say, in the decade since I left the University of Oregon's Historic Preservation Program and in the 5 years I spent working at Restore Oregon and the 5 years at the city, this has been the greatest mental gymnastics that my brain has attempted to play. And I don't know that I get a gold standard on finding the answer, but where we landed with the hierarchy and thinking about an intentional hierarchy is, I have to say, informed by the thinking of the 1970s and early 1980s about the city's historic preservation program. And this is not explained in great detail in the staff report, in part because we're trying to reach a decision maker audience that is the PSC and city council, and also give in the staff report information for a property owner or a more general audience or someone who's coming into this not necessarily wanting the full story. But a couple of things that I had sat with months ago as we developed the code proposals and then spent the weekend sitting with again were some great 1970s publications, like the proposal for conservation zoning that came out of Mayor Goldschmidt's office in 1977, and then the 1978 potential conservation district report that the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and the Landmarks Commission co-published in October of 1978. So going in the Wayback Machine 42 years ago, thinking about where the city was going, what direction we were on in protecting historic resources at a time when Oregon didn't have an owner consent law, and at a time when Portland was really on the vanguard nationally of historic preservation and the preservation system. Back in 1977, and this, I promise, will make sense in a minute, I hope. Back in 1977, the city had the experience of having created the Skidmore Old Town Historic District that then became listed on the National Register, the Yamhill Historic District that then became listed in the National Register, and we're looking at areas outside of the downtown core that would be good candidates for a degree of preservation. And the idea that came out of your predecessors on the Landmarks Commission and previous city councils was the idea of a conservation level of protection that recognized historic significance, but protected historic resources in a more neighborhood responsive way. And the first example of that, and I bring this up in part because the first example of that was the Lair Hill, now South Portland, conservation district. And the city adopted conservation zoning in 1977 as a vehicle to protect Lair Hill, and then subsequently Ladd's Addition, and then Irvington, Piedmont, Mississippi Woodlawn, in a way that was less restrictive and rigorous than we've protected historically the downtown districts and individual landmarks. And the thinking was that there are areas of the city that are important to protect, but that to protect them and to recognize the sort of nature of the stewards of those historic properties, the owners, the commercial tenants, the residential tenants, that resources outside of the downtown core might be best protected in a more flexible way. And in 1977, when the conservation zoning idea was codified, the phrase that was used in that document over and over again was historic districts that have historic significance and that are protected less than historic districts. And so the idea was places that were significant, places that deserve and are appropriate for protection, but that the protections be less than what was going on in the central city. And so Lehrer Hill becomes a conservation district in 1977. And then in 1978, the Landmarks Commission and City Council gave good thought to a long list of places that may be appropriate for conservation designation. And some of those are pretty familiar. They're Irvington, Laurelhurst, Kings Hill, Alphabet, Piedmont, Selwood, Woodlawn, Chinatown. And so in the late 70s, the city and the city council was thinking about how do you protect historic resources and how do you do it at two levels. And in this 1970s documentation, what wasn't considered was automatically regulating National Register listing. By the early 90s, before the owner consent law went into effect in 1995, the zoning code and the city's approach to district and landmark designation was really looking at a gold and silver approach to protection that was intended, not necessarily, as I've reviewed the code, to regulate based upon the significance of the resource, but decide those regulations based upon the appropriateness of protections. And in 1993, when the conservation districts that we know today were created by City Council, the intent wasn't to say that they were less important or less significant than a historic district, but because of the people who were living there, maybe the diversity of the resource types and the desire for additional flexibility, the conservation level of protection was applied rather than the historic level. So we get to the situation in the early 90s where Portland sort of has a historic districts are in the downtown core. Generally, outside of the downtown core is a lot of conservation districts. In 1995, we became the only state in the country with an owner consent law. Part of that owner consent law was a bypass to the owner consent law for National Register listing. And so right away in 1996, the city codifies a stopgap solution that we still use today, that National Register listing would automatically bring historic landmark or historic district status. And since that time, because of the convenience and the efficiency of using the National Register for automatic historic status, we haven't given a lot of thought to the conservation level of protection. One thing that happened in 2005 that I think has sort of dictated the course we've been on is that demolition review in 2005 was applied just to the historic level. So what you see is conservation level resources today with demolition delay, historic level resources with demolition review requirement. And we've seen the trend towards previous conservation districts being listed on the National Register for a variety of reasons, some research, some better documentation, and in some cases seeking the demolition review protection that comes with National Register. And I think we've seen that in South Portland, the Lehrer Hill Historic Conservation District that evolved to a Lehrer Hill Historic District, Ladd's Addition, Irvington, all of which previously been conservation districts that are moved up the ladder, not because they became more historically significant necessarily, but because that higher level of protection became desirable in light of demolitions. Tying it together, back when we started this process 3 years ago, one of the first things we heard in the concept open houses for the project back at end of the year 2017, early 2018, was an interest and desire for a menu of protection options, that an area, regardless of its significance, would have options for protection, and that there would be options to have demolition protections that would go beyond just National Register listing, which today the only vehicle for demolition review is National Register listing. And a lot of interest in retooling the conservation district protections to continue that flexibility that was imagined back in the 70s and through the 90s, but to give stronger protection to demolition and to give the community a voice in that discussion. And ultimately, when we looked at the conservation districts, we were left with this challenge of, we have six existing conservation districts, but we also have a lot of interest in the future for conservation designation. Like, it wants to be a Swiss Army knife of protections and preservation And places like Peacock Lane and Laurelhurst, which have recently been listed in the National Register, are subject to demolition protections but no design protections. And those areas thinking about what their future could look like, asking some questions about whether or not the full meal deal of historic district is the right protection remedy. And so where we landed, I would say, in the code amendments is a significant single step towards protecting those districts, in that demolition review is proposed at a lower level. So the it'd be a lower procedure type than historic districts, and with additional criteria that would be available to be met to get approved for demolition. But moving the line on the demolition protections and conservation districts and retaining their current, what we call two-track design standards and design or historic resource review, similar to what we do in the design overlay zone with two-track. And there was a lot of conversations in those design overlay zone amendments project about character buildings, and is there a way to sort of get a hybrid between historic preservation and design review. And those, it wasn't really the right project to do that. Conservation districts aren't quite that. But thinking about the most important piece of a conservation district is those things identified as contributing to the district. If they are lost, then there's nothing left to conserve. And so ultimately where we landed was, is the big step for conservation districts now, generally across the board, ensuring that there's demolition review, and then looking to the future to nuance district by district what the right design protections, if any, would be at a district by district level. And the fact that conservation districts have the option today and historically have had the option of the clear and objective design standards, that maybe that gives us the ability to be more nuanced in how conservation districts are protected at the design level. But fundamentally, if we don't have a protection program for contributing buildings, one, a National Register district could never evolve into a conservation district, because then we're talking about two very different protection programs. And two, as we've seen in the six existing conservation districts, the continued loss of contributing buildings leaves us with, at the end of the day, nothing left to conserve. So that is at a high level why we look to have the bold move be adding demo review, because professionally, I think that without stronger demolition protections, the conservation districts don't serve a strong long-term option for preserving historic resources. And two, given the change in state admin rule, to give a menu of options for protections, the conservation district serves as an intermediary between what the state says we can and must protect National Register resources with, and where we've seen a high level of success in preserving what we've called the gold standard, again, for a more general audience, how we've seen historic districts protected in the long term. So that was the thinking. The last thing I'll say is, in a state that requires owner consent for designation of resources, I think that menu is really important, so that we might get back to where we were at in the 1970s and 80s, thinking about, are there logical steps into protection? And then the flip side with the incentives that I think maybe we'll talk about later, are there ways for us to respond to the rigidity of the owner consent law by giving sort of a stair-step approach to protections and a stair-step approach to getting benefits on the incentive side of things? So that's sort of big picture where we came from. In the discussion draft, we landed on a staff-level demolition review for conservation districts, because state law says that National Register resources need a public hearing. That got me rethinking that to get that stair-stepping approach, the sort of nesting doll of protections to work with conservation districts being the silver standard, there would need to be a public hearing as well to dovetail off of what was required for National Register. I don't know that it's perfect. I doubt that it's perfect. But ultimately, the thinking I've had is, if we want to see new conservation districts listed in the future, if we want to have a suite of options for the right level of protection, not necessarily the right level of significance, foundationally, if we're losing the things that contribute to conservation districts, we're losing the essence of what it is that's intended to be conserved. Well, I'll stop there.
Yeah, and I think that is, you know, you've gone a quite a far way in making that happen in terms of, you know, setting the sort of bottom standard, you know, if you will, be the National Register sort of demo review. But I guess what I'm What I'm objecting to isn't necessarily any of the work that you've done around, you know, what should be the right level in conservation districts. Instead, what I'm objecting to, I think, is whether National Register even belongs on your chart at all. And I guess what I'm proposing is that National Register listed properties should just automatically slot into, you know, either a historic district or a conservation district. And we can sort of talk about that and which ones they should go into. But I'm just not even sure that National Register deserves a place on your chart at all.
And to respond to that, in the earlier drafts, like in the concept development, that was my thinking too, was that National Register should automatically continue to become a historic district or a historic landmark with a new exemption that met the state law. But the challenge I kept running up against, and maybe I'll invite Hillary to chime in if it's appropriate, is what we would end up with is a situation where some historic landmarks had demolition review and historic resource review, and other historic landmarks, those that are most recently listed in the National Register, only had demolition review and no historic resource review. Because of the new state administrative rule, it's cities can't automatically apply anything beyond demolition review to National Register. You have to have a separate public hearing and owner consent. And so the challenge I've had is in clearly communicating the protections that apply to a resource, the consequence of continuing to automatically have National Register become a historic landmark when it wouldn't be treated like other historic landmarks. And so that was where you're at, is where I was at in my first pass at it. And they kept ending up with, then it becomes a menu where you don't really know the recipe without getting into the code in any specific property. And I think this is something that former Chair Ranzetta and I talked about years ago. We amended some graphics we use because I think Chair Ranzetta was touching on something that you're touching on, which is that the level at which a resource is protected isn't always commensurate with the depth or breadth of its significance. There are many resources in the city. I mean, I'll think back to like the Workman Temple, or we might think to some of the Asian American Pacific Islander resources in the Jade District that are really, really important, but they have no designation status and they've not been inventoried. And so we have this, protections and significance aren't necessarily perfectly aligned. And they may in the future not be because of that under consent law. And so I think you're right on with questioning whether or not the hierarchy is about significance or about protections. And I've moved towards thinking that the hierarchy is about protections and not that the most significant resources are the most protected, because in our owner consent world, that may never be how it works out.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, in countless hours of discussion with Brandon and other folks from BDS, and sort of reaching certain conclusions as to what should be in this proposal, we have to think of it in terms of what are good policy choices, but what are our good implementation choices? And I think that what Brandon has come up with works really well with regard to implementation. It's easy to see it just by looking at the map, like which category you would fall into. Over the past 3.5 years or so now, more than 3.5 years, it's been pretty confusing with regard to certain resources, like in Laurelhurst, where there are hundreds of resources, and we still get questions as to whether or not proposals are subject to review or not. Whereas, like, if the resource is clearly distinguished as something that isn't subject to historic resource review, they would know that right away. Both the people that own the properties, staff, people who are working on the properties, contractors, it just makes it a lot simpler that way.
I know the rest of the commission will chime in. Maybe I'll beat Commissioner Roman to the punch really quick and then pass it back. And foundationally, one of the things that was on my mind is the Land Conservation and Development Commission, in adopting the new state rules that were made effective 3 years ago, the decision was a baseline of protection for National Register resources statewide would be demolition review, that would be the the minimum level of protections and the appropriate starting point for protections. And that decision resonates with me with the conservation districts of, hey, if the minimum level of protections for a National Register listing is demo review, then maybe for all of our designated resource types, that's our floor. And then we're building up off that floor. And I should say that there are some resources in the future that will probably be, if you peel back the zoning map layers, would probably be a National Register resource that is a conservation district and a historic district. And the code is set up that the highest level of protection is the name of the resource. So like Irvington is a conservation district. It's on the National Register and treated as a historic district. We just call it a historic district because that's the highest level of regulation. They nest nicely.
I get, Brent, I just have a question about the fluidity of being able to move from one classification to another. And so a new National Register district today basically doesn't get any protections other than demolition review, is my understanding. And that doesn't feel like enough protection for something that just got listed as a National Register district. How would that move up to a conservation district or to a historic district as a community-based effort and not reliant on the Planning Commission to do that? And similarly, it looks like there's provisions that would allow the Planning Commission to take what are now historic landmarks or historic districts and lower the designation to conservation district or National Register district. And that has implications about what incentives are available to the different properties, because historic districts and historic landmarks get a little more incentives than. So I'm just curious, it's built in there that they can lower the current designation from gold to bronze, but do you see that happening? And how would a public process be involved in that sort of a, what if you want to be conserved as a historic district, a new arrival, so to speak? Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe I'm going to take this in parts. And maybe this is the product of being like a 1980s kid and thinking that like there was something good about the 80s. I don't know, but I keep looking back at the code and thinking that we had some things right before the owner consent law changed everything up. And I look at the other cities around the country who have similarly long experiences with preservation and have done a lot of work in recent decades to diversify their historic resource inventories, to create adaptive reuse incentives, to have done some of the work that we haven't necessarily intentionally thought of by our passive relationship with the National Register serving as the basis for how our historic resource program has grown. And I should say, we haven't updated our citywide inventory since 1984, which puts us way at the bottom of the list of the active engagement of the City Landmarks Commission, the community, our city council in making these intentional equity moves to build a more representative set of historic resource designations and classifications citywide. So today in the code, the Planning and Sustainability Commission in the code is responsible for making recommendations to City Council on issues that affect the zoning code and the zoning map. The only exception from that in the code today has to do with the recommendation of design guidelines. This is a legislative decision. So unlike your quasi-judicial work where you're reviewing alterations, additions, new construction, demolitions, in legislative proceedings today, the Planning and Sustainability Commission on paper is responsible for making changes to the code and the map. Theoretically, the Planning and Sustainability Commission could recommend to City Council that new strong protections get applied to specific historic districts or specific landmark buildings, and they could make that recommendation as a code change, or they could recommend it as a map change. In the proposal, just to break things out a little bit, the Historic Landmarks Commission would recommend to City Council updates to the historic resource inventory that were individual property based. So if you wanted to say, council, we think these additional 500 buildings in East Portland should be added to the inventory as significant resources, and hey, 12 of those building owners are willing to go for landmark status, the code proposal puts the Landmarks Commission in the driver's seat of making recommendations to council on individual property additions to the historic resource inventory. And that would allow us to move out of neutral on the historic resource inventory updates we've talked about for a long time, putting the commission in a place where you could say, we think these 30 properties should be added to the inventory. Council, will you do that? So you'd be the recommending body on inventory updates for individual properties. For individual buildings, so single sites that are listed in the National Register, let's use the Billy Webb Elks Lodge as an example. We've proposed a new type one process where if an individual building goes on the National Register and the owner is willing to consent to a conservation landmark or historic landmark designation on top of that National Register listing, they could do it with the type one procedure. So today, I think, Hillary, I might pick on you. I think a type one review fee is $300. So that is a cost. State law says it has to be a land use decision. Type one is our lowest level land use decision. So my thinking has been, if an owner nominates a property to the National Register, is successful in getting on the National Register, and they want to be at the silver or gold level of protection, the easiest and most efficient way to do it is a type one application in and out. Or they could say, hey, Historic Landmarks Commission, I don't have $300 to spend. Can you put this in your next batch of recommendations to council? So for the individual resource, I want to pull those apart a little bit, because there's the proposal would be that those decisions are either made quasi-judicially or by the city council in a legislative action where this commission is the recommending body. Districts, in the code proposals, there's no change from the current code regarding the promotion or demotion of an entire district. What is spelled out more clearly is that that is something that can happen. You know, that today is not spelled out, articulated in the code, that things can move up and down. It's more of a binary in or out. And that there are criteria proposed for eligibility for listing and removal. I had been under the assumption or under the belief that that had always been that way in the zoning code, that the Planning and Sustainability Commission was the recommending body on districts. And that has been the case since the 1990s, but I did go back this weekend and do some homework, because this has come up as a, an area of a lot of good, robust discussion. And in the 1970s, it was the Historic Landmarks Commission who recommended the city council the designation or removal of both landmarks and districts. So there is precedent for this commission having done that in the past. I think I had maybe erroneous information in the commentary or staff report. I know I've said to a few people that it's always been that way, but always was not accurate, that the Landmarks Commission previously had made the recommendation. But I think there's one thing to think about, and that's it, because city council ultimately is the decision maker. As you provide comments and advice on these code proposals, helping the Planning and Sustainability Commission understand the best role you'd be in for making those decisions, I think would be helpful. And then two, if we're going to be proposing a process, clearer process with criteria for designating new resources at the local level, I have felt it's incumbent on me as city staff to propose the flip side, which is what would make a resource no longer eligible for removal. And even today, I'm reminded of the removal of the statues and the park blocks. And as the arc of history bends and twists, if we are protecting resources because of their importance to the community, and we lack a venue for having a discussion about their removal, I don't know that puts us in the best place as stewards of history and as people who are committed to long-term preservation. Those criteria in the process, I think, are important. And I'm not sure we got it perfectly right in the code proposals, and I think that's where you all come in to give feedback about what would make it work better. I will say, last thing is, in the past, when the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended the creation of the Albina Conservation Districts, in that recommendation to council was a similar motion to right zone or to adopt new design standards or to make other moves in the zoning code or the zoning map to make the district work better at the time of designation. We haven't been afforded that ability with the National Register and the automatic application of historic district status, which has put us in that sort of reactionary seat of saying, for example, Chinatown, why are the height limits in Chinatown what they are? Well, it's because it was listed on the National Register, became a historic district, and there was no package of zoning code refinements to make it all work together, like we saw back before 1995 with the conservation districts and the earlier historic districts.
Well, I guess I just, you read the document, and there's some pretty clear language in there that is scary to me because it, you know, it would take a lads addition and lower it down basically to no protections whatsoever. And I don't want to say people are going to do that. I don't think that's the motivation, but it's pretty laid out. You know, listed resources that were automatically identified as historic landmarks and historic districts in the past to have their city designation changed or removed in the future as a result of historic designation removal review or legislative decision based on policies of the comprehensive plan. You know, so that's where I worry that we didn't get enough history stuff in the comp plan. I don't want to be alarmist, but I would ask if I can just wrap up this comment. Just,
oh, yeah.
If you haven't read volume one, my fellow commissioners, you really need to. And I know it's, you know, it's not the most fun stuff, but there's some concerning language in there that makes me feel like we're not going to do as good a job protecting historic resources that we identify going forward. So anyway.
Let me talk about that for just a second. I do think that this code package is really trying to address problems. And, you know, yes, I had to take a deep breath myself, and I definitely, you know, I don't want to be pointing any fingers. I think what we need to do is really work with the PSC and work with Brandon to try to move a couple of important, you know, sort of big picture points forward. And one of those is certainly around, you know, districts. So I think, Brandon, what you were saying about individual resources in this code package, I have no concerns whatsoever. I think the way that they're treated, you know, and sort of the way that individual property owners can use, you know, the incentives that are in here. It's exciting to me that we're really getting it in terms of individual resources. And so I think all of our concerns really stem from, you know, what do districts look like, right? So whether it's conservation districts or National Register or historic districts. And I totally agree that there needs to be a mechanism to change boundaries, to remove districts, you know, from our local registry. You know, just, you know, anybody who's lived here for 20 years and who's been driving up and down, you know, Williams and Vancouver doesn't get a sense that that is necessarily part of a functioning district of anything. And yet we need surety, I think, that there is value in a city designation, and there's a way for neighborhoods to get there. And I think something that does rub me the wrong way in this code package is the idea of equity. I mean, not the idea of equity itself rubbing me the wrong way, but that for a new district, for a new neighborhood, I should say, to form a locally designated district, it just seems like there are so many barriers now. And, you know, of course, what you're saying is true, Brandon, in that most of those barriers have already been in place, and there really hasn't been a mechanism for any local listing because of owner consent. So now seems like the time to get that right and to actually make it an available sort of way that a neighborhood can have a voice in what gets preserved, and you know, whether even maybe it's part of a conservation district, maybe it's not. But you know, it just seems to me that addressing equity means that we have to stop saying that National Register is the only level available, because guess what? Guess what happened? Oh, that meant that all of the, you know, wealthy district and town that haven't had a lot of change, where, you know, the people there can actually come up with the money to do the research, the background, you know, and then go through this city process, which is kind of a lot. I mean, it's not under National Register, mind you. It's free, and there's not a lot of process other than just, you know, sort of writing the document. But now, you know, you're saying on the one hand, oh, you know, we're getting rid of owner consent, which is awesome. But then, you know, you're sort of taking away this availability of creating any new locally listed districts because of the hoops that would be caused, you know, to neighborhoods that are probably less wealthy and have, you know, less fabric that would necessarily, you know, meet those strict standards. So that's where I get really concerned, is that, you know, when we talk about equity, let's be careful about that, because I think equity is not necessarily, you know, sort of putting the same level of process on everybody. At the same time, I do advocate for a threshold which is based on National Register somewhat loosely. I advocate for, you know, these neighborhoods, whoever I'm talking about, who want to achieve a local listing. I think there has to be a survey process. I think there has to be an eligibility process. And, you know, we can't get rid of that. Otherwise, it's just sort of like, oh, everybody gets to, you know, call their own shots. And that's not what I'm advocating for either.
Brandon, I have a question. Has there been any discussion at BPS about codifying the requirement to do some level of survey every year and bring that forward to Landmarks Commission and the City Council, recognizing that that would be a financial commitment that BPS had to ask for in each budget?
That's a good question. There hasn't been, at least not to that specificity. I think, and this is something Commissioner Roman mentioned, I think we do have a really strong slate of comp plan goals and policies about historic resources, about expanding the inventory. That doesn't translate directly to budget, but I would say that this is one of the reasons why you've already moved this direction, but there's a code amendment that would have the Landmarks Commission forever on give your annual report to City Council during the budgeting process, which is like exactly where I think, you know, you'd be best, you're the sort of best moment to bring that perspective. But there, you know, from my bosses, you know, I am scoped with finishing this project and several others, and then we're just sort of on the what are the City Council priorities and what are the priorities of you know, the people of the city who participate in that process. I since I've got the mic, as it were, I do want to correct one thing Commissioner Miner said, and not even a correction, but it's about the owner consent law. Today's zoning code requires unanimous owner consent to designate a resource, and the proposed changes eliminate reference to owner consent and default to the new state admin rule, which says it's 50% plus one. And so, you know, we're sort of moving from a situation where it's virtually impossible to create a district to a position where we could create a district. It would still require the majority buy-in of those in the district and the decision. And the last thing I'll say, I want to turn back to everyone, that this tension that Commissioner Roman is talking about is, I think, how do I say, was strongly on my mind as we thought about the incentives that, like, and I, you know, hindsight's 2020 in the language it's used in the staff report, the code, but I think that there's opportunities for historic resources, not just to meet the comp plan, not just to meet the comp plan well, but to be exemplar places where a variety of comp plan goals and policies are met. And I think that the reuse incentives are one of our best chances at seeing that that needle really move. And of course, it's a rights and responsibilities piece. And there'll be some current discomfort, I think, in seeing historic places get more intensively used, more creatively used, break from the mold of what has sort of been the established, let's say, the R5 zoning expectation. But to make the case for their preservation, to bring people back into districts that maybe have been displaced, to create the justification to apply protections. Of all the code proposals, I see those adaptive reuse pieces just being so critically important, not only to convince an owner that designation is a good idea, not only to convince a decision maker that a designation aligns with city goals and policies, but really to make historic preservation back to being a core part of the growth and development of the city for generations that are yet to be here. And I don't know that I got them right from the staff perspective. I've been saying this at a lot of the outreach events. I am really excited about the conversation, but I think it's critically important that we think about historic resources both in the past and also in the future. And they need to have useful life, and they need to be places that can be adapted and be creatively reused to continue to make the case of their, you know, ongoing preservation, I think.
I absolutely agree with that 100%. I don't want to sound negative because the incentive stuff that's in here is wonderful. I just want to sum up my overall concern about our last topic is that basically it feels like we're deciding that although it was worthy of getting on the National Register of Historic Places, all it gets from us is demo review, but we're really not applying any design review standards or anything to, National Register. I wish that we would value the national, I mean, everything I've seen that's gone on the National Register since I've been on the commission, it all looked like it warranted some kind of, protection. And I guess on page 11, there's a comment about the special assessment program. And it says, although a state program, cities are expected to, and Portland does, monitor property owner compliance with the rehabilitation standards that are required of enrollment. I don't know how that would continue with the current, maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems like we're not, as a city, saying let's protect, the stuff that's on the National Register or districts that are worthy of being on the national. I'm more concerned about the districts than anything, as Kristen Miner said. But anyway, that's my main concern with the overall changes. And in addition to the conservation, just how undefined our conservation districts have been, and that because of the the alternative prescriptive path, that we really aren't doing a lot to conserve or even know what we're conserving. So it seems weird that those conservation districts would get a higher level of protection than National Register District. But I understand your argument about why, we're prioritizing one over the other in terms of not saying one's worth more or less. We've just decided we're not going to prioritize new National Register districts for protection. So,
can I respond to that? I've never thought of it that way, just because I feel like what we are proposing is the maximum that we can do without establishing another process to elevate their status. We can't apply historic resource review to National Register resources by state law. We're not allowed. And so they have to go through a process to elevate their status so that we can do that. Also, with regard to special assessments, I don't know how often it is, but it's 3 to 4 times a year. I usually get a packet from SHPO where they are reviewing projects that are in that program. And I verify that either they got a historic resource review approval for the changes that they made, or that they that those resources aren't designated within our historic resource review umbrella. So we still see them, and I think that's what Brandon meant.
Well, wasn't it the admin rule change, though, not the Oregon owner consent law, that really triggered all this? Because prior to 2017, And I kind of feel like the admin rule change was to allow all this. It was to create a problem so that we'd have to fix something. And I don't know if, you know, automatically, I don't understand the whole why the admin role was changed, but prior to that, they were able to put all the National Register listings as a lump into landmark status. So, I mean, it was just, I don't know if I'll ever understand all the nuances of that, but it seems like it wasn't the owner consent law. It was the admin rule that, in 2017 that triggered all this. So I take your point though. I'm glad to hear Shippo send you all the, I'm sorry if I'm a downer, you guys. I'm not trying to be a downer. I really appreciate all the hard work that Brandon's done on this. And there's some great stuff in here. I worry that this whole tension over historic districts is being resolved in a way that makes it really difficult for anybody to ever do it again. There's a gatekeeper that's never going to open the gate. I don't mean to be derogatory because I don't know people's motives, but I don't get the sense that the city wants more historic districts based on the previous history. So
one quick response, if that's okay, Treminer. When the admin rule changed in 2017, I participated in the process and I felt strongly that it was the right direction to go, not just for the city of Portland, but statewide, having looked at what all their states do. And maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but I'm thinking about the house that Commissioner Roman is sitting in today. And buildings outside of Portland that had been listed in the National Register in the past were not protected with any automatic demolition review, whereas cities like Portland were applying the maximum level of protection of the National Register listing. And the fundamental expectation of the rulemaking advisory group, on which I sat, was to provide a statewide baseline for National Register resources. And the baseline that was proposed was demolition delay statewide. I think through that process, I became increasingly convinced that there are good reasons why 49 other states don't rely on the National Register to convey automatic protections, that there are consequences of that that are out of the control of landmarks commissions, preservation professionals, and it's a tool that could be used for good and not so good reasons. But I am reminded that in that rulemaking exercise, jurisdictions around the state came to an agreement of finding one common statewide baseline so that the Oregon SHPO and others could tell a property owner, a group of owners, exactly what regulatory effect an Oregon National Register listing would have. And I think about buildings like 1840s farmhouses in rural Oregon that had owners who listed them on the National Register and they became subject to demolition review and the opportunity for public discussion. And in Portland, where frankly, there has not been the opportunity for citywide dialogue at the time of listing about whether or not that there's historic significance, but whether or not there's what level of protection might be appropriate to default to the highest level of protection. I would be surprised if we all aren't aware of where that has failed the sort of public trust and the integrity of the preservation program in discussions that have played out in large residential neighborhoods. And so I'm looking back at this 1978 document that talks about all the areas that could be listed as conservation and historic districts. And frankly, most of those have been listed locally or on the National Register. And so I think that part of it is about thinking about the City Council, thinking about your colleagues in the Planning and Sustainability Commission, thinking about where the most important resources are to prioritize for district status, as opposed to letting that be a process that just sort of happens by the will of groups of property owners. And so I think, you know, like minds can disagree on this, but I'm increasingly convinced that the public and political support for the protection of a place is equally important in its designation as it is in its ongoing protection. And if the buck stops at City Council and our City Council doesn't believe that a place is worthy of protections because of the way it was designated, then demolition permits probably won't be given full review and a decision towards protection. I mean, I think it's about ensuring that there's public trust and belief in the resources that are being designated for protection. And that there is a tangible benefit that comes with designation for the city rather.
Where do we line up then, Brandon, if demolition review is the base minimum. Like, are other, what are other states doing? Is that the standard that other states are applying? Is there another state that's doing it better that we could look at so that as a city we could, you know, not just be the minimum, but I don't know, not have to micromanage everybody either. I do appreciate some of that in here. Anyway, I've taken too much time. I'll let my.
Not at all. You are supposed to be, you know, helping to lead this group through this. So I really.
I appreciate you, Brandon Spencer Hartle, very much. I don't think we disagree maybe as much as you think, and I don't want to cast dispersions on the Planning Commission because they've got a hard job to do too. And I just, you know, I just want to make sure that we're all clear on what we're doing here. The ability to lower a historic landmark or a historic or landmark district down the chain. It worries me. It means we didn't do a very good job conserving it. So
I think too, anyway. One thing I'll say is we are the only state in the country that automatically applies land use protections to National Register. And to my knowledge, we're the only large city in the country that does that. So most places, National Register is the information that's used for discussions around designation at the local level. So we're a little different, but I'm reminded too, back in the 1990s when the conservation districts were created and, I think we all know enough about context and about Albina at the time and about the Albina Community Plan that there was a decision that was made that those places were really important but would be protected at a lower level. And I have concern that some of that decision came out of, quite frankly, what was a belief that those places don't deserve the highest level of protection. But I also know from the documentation that there was sensitivity given to the financial situations of the people who lived in and owned property there, that having the rigorous bar of historic district status for historic resource review required for exterior alterations may not always be the right approach for a community for whom access to the capital and financial opportunities to go through historic resource review meet those standards is a possibility. And so I'm reminded that sometimes a decision about the level of protection may have less to do about the importance of the resource and more to do with the needs of the people who live there. And I'm thinking about what areas of the city aren't represented today on the historic resource inventory, and that having a menu of options to approach different communities with, you know, acknowledging, elevating, representing their histories, but ensuring that city regulations aren't a burden, but are an opportunity is part of my thinking on the level of protection discussion.
So Brandon, one of the things that I have started to really think about in a little bit more depth is the idea that, you know, we of course as preservationists really believe in the idea that adaptive reuse is a serious win for sustainability. I mean, that's kind of one of the, you know, the backbones of preservation is that, you know, it is a sustainable course of action. But I think it's also, we need to keep in mind that it's only sustainable if property owners are choosing to actually add units as opposed to demolish. You know, if they're choosing to add an ADU or convert their garage or do that work, that's when, you know, leaving a house becomes more sustainable than tearing it down, right? And I also want to say that, you know, wealthy, you know, mostly white neighborhoods are exclusive and unaffordable, whether or not they're historic. So, you know, you can compare, I don't know, Alameda, say, I don't want to pick on them necessarily, it could be Kings Hill, wherever, you know, or not Kings Hill, but West Hills, you know, somewhere that's not a historic district and is quite wealthy. And, you know, we have failed just as much there, you know, maybe even more so than we've failed in these wealthy historic districts, right? So if we're looking at Kings Hill, like I just said, or Irvington. And so I started to kind of think about a comparative study. Like, let's look at single family, because I think that's where we're all really honing in on, you know, that's where the problems lie from the city's perspective. You know, what are those benefits to the greater good, right? Let's make sure that these districts, if we're going to apply protections, and you know, whether or not they're derived from a city or a national register, you know, putting that aside for a second, but if they have protections, let's also have more asks in terms of meeting comp plan goals. So, you know, what if neighborhoods that were historic actually had to sort of sign a good neighbor agreement, a good neighborhood agreement, and present every year the data about how many units, you know, whether or not those units are actual units or Airbnb, you know, how are they, you know, how are they increasing density? And maybe at some point there's even sort of a negative consequence, you know, if they don't do anything about it for 5 years, I don't know what that level is, that, you know, this body, whoever is listening to them, maybe it's a PSC, I don't know, you know, they're sort of in charge of, you know, this comp plan. So great, give them the ability to actually say to this neighborhood, look, you know, you're not going to be allowed to have Airbnb in your neighborhood anymore, or no more new curb cuts, or something that's kind of, you know, punitive on that neighborhood, but, you know, can get to comp plan goals. I think what we're struggling with right now is that historic districts actually are better meeting some comp plan goals than non-historic districts. And I think there's this equation of, you know, sort of exclusion being given to historic neighborhoods that actually should just apply to all of these wealthy white neighborhoods, whether or not they're historic. And so I think that's, I think looking at it from that perspective could actually move the needle towards working with the comp plan, I mean, working with the PSC to make sure our comp plan is better met, you know, by historic preservation. You know, there's a lot there already, and there could be more.
I'll add to that. There's nothing, and I think Kara Faravanti made this point at our subcommittee meeting, that there's nothing inherent about historic districts that limits density. And so it's a false narrative to suggest that because you're a historic district, you can't accommodate just as many people as a non-historic district. And I think that's to piggyback on Commissioner Miner's comment right there, that, and you know, I don't know if this, I like the flexibility of, you know, maybe allowing more uses too. We've talked about historically, neighborhoods had smaller apartment buildings. So it doesn't have to be like a giant building or just keep it all single family residential. Anyway, I just wanted to make that point. So.
Yeah. So I think I would like to petition PSC, you know, City Council if necessary, for a little time to suss out the idea that in, you know, as part of an equation of rights and responsibilities, that requesting protections, you know, especially at that lowest level, could be a really good thing everywhere, you know, wherever districts want to form, or, you know, I mean, why is that necessarily a bad thing? I think it's a bad thing when it doesn't lead to more density, and we can address that. You know, we can probably devise, you know, something that's a little bit more, you know, more requirements in terms of a layering, you know, on these districts. What I hope is that, you know, we're not ending up with something that's different for each neighborhood. You know, I mean, when I said a good neighborhood agreement and sort of leave it at that, maybe that's the way we do it, is just that each neighborhood really has to look at what's achievable for them, and, you know, there needs to be somebody reviewing the data with them, and, you know, how they're pushing, you know, their individual homeowners to make changes. I don't know. It could be a really great way to, you know, sort of work on this rights and responsibilities balancing act.
As another approach to that same idea is, you know, and I know Commissioner Mahoney is working on the new guidelines for the area we were just talking about, is, you know, is there a way to write into the guidelines, you know, addressing promoting density? You know, is there it's not just preservation, it's, you know, we want this historic district to have more units. And so, I don't know, I'm just trying to think of a way to build it into the current system through some sort of a guideline aspect. I don't know, it's hard to force people to spend money that they don't want to spend building ADUs. But I'm not sure how practical, you know, forcing someone to do something, but there's got to be a way. Anyway, that's just my thought. So.
Yeah.
I think, Chair Minor, this would be a great discussion with your colleagues on Planning and Sustainability Commission. And I think that there'll be a lot of interest in that. I think one other thing, and this was sort of forecasted in broad terms in the potential future work in the staff report, that last section, is we're thinking citywide with these code amendments, like the refinements to the big framework. And I think that there are some good questions about whether or not existing conservation districts, once we know what the next iteration of the conservation district protections look like, you know, is there a need for a resurvey? Do we need to look at the boundaries? Do we need to go and address a DOZET style project that would refine those standards to have them work a little better, maybe be a little more nuanced to the districts? And I know that there will be, it's already in the testimony on the MAP app, which I'd encourage all of you to review yourself with what other people are saying that's available online for this project. You know, interest in talking about district specific issues. And, you know, I don't know if it's this project, if it's a complement to this project, if it's the next iteration, but I do think your colleagues on the Planning and Sustainability Commission will be very interested in the discussion about opportunities and opportunities for historic preservation to advance the full plate of city goals in a way that maybe existing buildings can't, or the base zoning can't, that we've got something unique here to work with. Last thing I'll say too, as you think about your Landmarks Commission comments, I know you've got a lot more time to, not a lot more time, but a lot of time set aside to keep working through them, is in the proposed draft, we've tried to break down the themes. And if there are areas that the commission feels really good about, to the extent that you can say we're really good with theme 1A, but mm-hmm. we've got a lot of concern about theme 3B or 2B, it could be helpful for the commission, since as staff, I've been advised to try to the extent possible for PSC to break up the testimony into those themes so that they know here's a tough knot to work through, and here's something that, you know, is benign, we're fine with.
Okay. That seems fair.
Brandon, can I ask one more question? Just on a different topic, but just something that occurred to me. Things like the Portland Public School inventory or the work that's done on Barber Boulevard in advance of the TriMet, is that data going to automatically be captured into this system somehow so that we're leveraging all this money that people are spending doing surveys? Or is there some way to kind of pull all that together so that we can actually get it into our HRI without, you know, having to dig it up again?
Yeah, I'm thrilled you asked the question. I think Chair Minor may know a thing or two about the long-range thinking on the HRI. But my hope would be by recasting the HRI as the full list, that HRI is just the way we describe historic resources. And by moving towards a system that looks like the umbrella graphic on page 24 of the staff report, you know, where we've got all these different resource types that are on the HRI. Some of those are regulated by the zoning code. Some of those are really regulated because they're landmarks or districts. That in a future, what I'd like to see happen is all that data gets shared with the city, incorporated into the HRI, and then you at the commission evaluate it in batches, elevate to city council recommendations for, you know, batches of resources to be identified as significant resources, and then decide how to prioritize efforts to work with those owners on potential landmark designation. That would be a way to move us out of neutral in a big way on updating our citywide map, the information, and then how to prioritize. Because I think, you know, part of it is there's just a big backlog of existing data. And there's also huge parts of the city that have never been looked at. And if we want to think about the idea of equity in historic resources, half of it is looking backwards. Whose histories are reflected on that map? Are they elevated to landmark status? You know, what geographies of the city are missing? And then the other half is looking forward and thinking, okay, how can Portlanders in the future engage with, you know, have a relationship with, benefit from preservation? And so that backwards piece, looking to the past, I think that's where we've got a ton of work to take existing research and then add to it, just for our foundational understanding of the past, because I think we, as we see even this morning, we have a lot of work to do to make sure that all histories are reflected on that inventory.
And Brandon, I really meant to go through a longer list of, you know, some of the great stuff in this code package, you know, before diving off into sort of my, you know, my concerns.
I've known you long enough. We'll save the platitudes.
Well, the HRI really is, you know, it represents something very exciting, I think, in terms of just creating a pathway, you know, for buildings out there that, you know, we may not know anything about right now and really have never been looked at through this lens. And, you know, sort of having the ability to know something about what's out there before decisions are made. So thank you. I also did want to mention briefly that I think the new relaxed regulations around parking and loading are excellent. I mean, I think that's one example of sort of how historic districts could go a little bit above and beyond. And that's the kind of thing that I would expect to, you know, to be a great, you know, moving that needle, like, you know, rights and responsibilities, like we already talked about. Okay. I know we have a work session on next week. Commissioners who haven't really weighed in, do you have any questions right now or, you know, comments? I know it's been kind of me and Matthew mostly who have gone through this more than you have for sure.
As Commissioner Mahoney, I have a lot of questions, but not enough time today, so
I know.
I'll wait till next week.
Well, and you can send those to us as well, you know. Matthew and Derek and I have been really trying to do a deep dive, and so whatever you have will help us. So
I think if commissioners do you have questions that they don't want to ask right now, but they want to make sure that there's discussion on them next week, funnel them to me and I'll get them out to the whole group. Hopefully it's one piece, but and yeah, if there are things that you know that you want to discuss more in depth now that aren't necessarily questions, feel free to mention those.
And I may just get in touch with Brandon and ask some of them, because it's probably more me just not having a lot of experience with land use. So I could get some clarity there.
Any other commissioners?
No, just thanks to you guys for doing that deep dive. It's a lot, so thank you for taking that on. I'm sure it's very time consuming.
Since we have Brandon, I want to ask one last question. For the little iconic streetscapes, I think of Hawthorne and the Baghdad, which I know is a protected. I mean, is there any impetus on the Planning Commission's part to actually go out and try to identify those? And I mean, they'd be the only people at this point that can really try to protect those areas, I think. Is that, I mean, I don't know, do we make a list and say, look, I think these iconic streetscapes are worth protecting? It's basically a Planning Commission initiated process as far as I can tell. Or we could try to initiate it by, I don't know, writing a letter or something. I'm curious how you think these code amendments might help us protect those types of resources.
Yeah, good question.
Are you getting them on the list, even as a significant resource, as a streetscape, so to speak? I don't know.
Yeah, I was looking. I've been looking at some data that I thought could be useful, and that's it. From what I, as I understand from this afternoon, from a data request that I pulled, our districts, National Register, Conservation and Historic Districts, are pretty equally representative of the city's zoned area. About 45% of our districts are single dwelling zoned. About 30% of our districts are open spaces, so Mount Tabor, Peninsula Park. And then we've got a variety of other multi-dwelling, mixed use, commercial zoning in our districts. And so the districts, from what I'm seeing, and just, I'll be talking with Planning Commission about this, are pretty representative of the city's overall zoned area, which means we talk a lot about the single dwelling districts, and I think for good reason. They've been the most recent, they're big, Irvington, Lads Edition, Laurelhurst, you know, for a variety of reasons, I think there's a reason why we have a discussion about those places. But a lot of our districts look like the Kenton Commercial Historic District or the part of the Piedmont Conservation District around Killingsworth and Albina, or mm-hmm. places that are Lads Edition on the fringes. And so I can't speak on behalf of Planning Commission, so I think it's a good question for them. But what I can say is, if you need, for the National Register and for local, 50% of owners to buy in. And to date, National Register has been the only vehicle to get demolition protection. That's been the only choice for those places if they want to do something different that might protect their context. Some of my thinking with the Conservation District proposal is that in many of those Main Street areas that you mentioned, they're in the D overlay for design review. And the way that D overlay works is it's two-track. So it's required design review unless you meet the standards. And effectively, conservation districts are two-track. Historic resource review unless you meet the standards. And so the dovetailing that could work if these code amendments are the right path, and if, you know, I think that the thinking is adding a small conservation designation to a place like the core of Multnomah Village or the core of St. John's would be dovetailing with the existing application of the D overlay. The standards might look different. The standards may be more responsive to place, but there'd be a demolition protection that would come in. And so in terms of that incremental bump towards preservation, that if conservation districts only required a majority owner consent, if conservation district allowed for the two-track design standards and guidelines, the only big regulatory move would be towards protecting buildings at a greater level from demolition. It may better align with some of the discussions that have happened in recent years around the mixed-use zones projects and the low-rise commercial areas. Again, I think I can't forecast what the Planning and Sustainability Commission or my colleagues will prioritize. But my thinking about the conservation designation is how could it work in precisely those situations where you're meeting in the middle between what would be a historic district level of protection and today what's sort of driven by the design overlay zone, which is sort of a high degree of change. I don't know the conservation districts would be like, you know, the whole length of Hawthorne or something like that, but they could be a more targeted, nuanced tool if we get them right. And, you know, some of my thinking is having that tool on the table, it lets us have that conversation where today we're sort of talking in the abstract about what it could mean.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think the conservation concept helps us focus on what we're trying to conserve, so to speak, and in a narrow targeted way. I think that could work. So,
and Kenton Commercial District is maybe the best example. Kenton was identified in 1978 as having, you know, good candidate for designation as a district. In 1993, it became a conservation district in the center of the donut on Denver Avenue. In the mid-90s, moved up to historic district because that conservation level of protection wasn't enough. And so it sort of gives you a model of what that could look like.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's definitely worth thinking about.
I will say one last thing I didn't mention. I did have a nice impromptu conversation with Commissioner Spears, and I know Commissioner Spears has a lot of good insights and questions to be brought to the table. And I know he's not here today, but I'm looking forward to his comments and questions at the next work session.
Fantastic. Okay, well, a lot to digest and a lot to still think about. Everybody, I guess, just try to get ready for next week, and we'll try to hash out more of this. We do have a type 3 case ready to present, and why don't we go ahead and take, it's almost 4:30. Why don't we say till 4:35, so not quite 10 minutes break. Sound good to everybody? Okay, 4:35 then. We'll see you back here at that time.